Good afternoon, folks. My name is Craig Moser. I'm here from Philadelphia. It's a wonderful street festival, and you are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, ACRA.
Tune in or turn out. Wednesday, May 26th, from 7:30 p.m. to 11 p.m. at the Greenville Drive-In to WGXC's 10th Anniversary Drive-In event, with performances from Brian DeWan from Catskill, Stephen Merritt of the Magnetic Fields, legendary radio artist Anna Friz, Lunar Moss, Jess Spear, Jeff Economy and Alana Medlek, Jen Cutler and Quentin Anna Wixwo, Mayuko Fujino, DJ Var, and Dan Seward from the Battlefield Earth Show, plus films from Charles and Ray Eames and Heath Iverson. Turn out to celebrate 10 years of community broadcasting on 90.7 FM at WGXC's 10th Anniversary Drive-In event. The Greenville Drive-In, Wednesday, May 26th from 7:30 p.m. to 11 p.m. Festivities get underway at sunset at 9 p.m. and can also be heard on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Leah Bertucci of Ridgewood, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Reports indicate that the best protection from radioactive fallout is a shelter.
Yet less than 5% of our population has one.
Do you?
Now, from Survival, one of the nation's leading manufacturers, comes an economical combination steel and concrete block, civil defense approved fallout shelter, offering maximum protection from nuclear fallout and falling debris.
FHA approved, you need nothing down. 5 years to pay.
Will you be prepared in case of atomic attack?
Will you and your loved ones be protected from nuclear fallout and falling debris?
For your family's protection from nuclear fallout, see a survival shelter today.
You're listening to Wireless Reconnaissance, Broadcast Surveillance, Transmission Art, and more Saturdays on WGXC 90.7 FM Creative Community Radio.
Welcome back to another episode of Wave Pharmacy. I'm one half of your hosts, Jen Cutler.
I am Tim Light.
And today we have a very, very special guest with us. We have the distinct honor of Dr. John Wixwo from Vanderbilt University, among many other amazing places. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's nice to meet you.
So John, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and what you do?
Well, I'm a plumber, a carpenter, and an electrician. Officially certified as a PhD in physics. I probably should list that as a hobby. I'm a tenured professor of physics, molecular physiology and biophysics, and biomedical engineers. And I think the physicists think that I'm a biologist, and the biologists think that I'm an engineer, and the engineer think that I'm a physicist. So as long as I can move quickly between all three topics, I'm kind of safe. But it's kind of like a moving cloud of dust. I've worked on a whole variety of projects. Measured the magnetic field of the human heart for both understanding electrical and mechanical activity. Made the first measurements of the magnetic field of an isolated nerve axon. Took that technology and used it to do non-destructive testing of aging aircraft. So I had the pleasure of walking, doing a wing walk on a B-52. Luckily, it was in the hangar instead of flying. Worked on non-destructive testing of electric power equipment, so I have some very large pieces of copper in my lab, and have been doing cardiac electrophysiology. Our group laid the foundation for the modern understanding of how cardiac defibrillation works. One of my serious hobbies has been to try to demonstrate, or actually convince people, that judicial electrocution is cruel and unusual punishment. Right now I'm working on organs on chips, which are basically little plastic chambers in which you can grow cells to try to make a microhuman or a nanohuman. And I've claimed that the microhuman is Homo chippus, and the nanohuman is Homo minutus, and build strange weapons. So I've invented a fair number of stuff. I have 39 issued patents and a few pending, and published a fair number of papers on a variety of things. I have a patent on the use of superconducting magnetometers for the detection of parasites in fish. So if you ever happen to want to find parasites in fish, I can sell you a very sophisticated gadget. Right now you find parasites in fish by staring at them like you would candle an egg and look for the dots of the parasites. So I've done a variety of things, and this is the this is in fact today a very special experience, because I've never been on a live radio show before.
I can't believe
I'm down here.
First, yeah, for a first for
I'm just going to bed.
Yeah, for all of you that are tuning in who are not in the studio, I'm just going to let you know that Tim's eyes are bugged out and falling out of his head.
Yeah, pretty much. So, like, you know, zip tie my mouth closed.
Do you have any experience in mental health professionally?
One could argue that to be perfectly honest, for many years I suffered from a severe case of imposter syndrome, because being trained as a physicist, I was convinced that I had to hold myself up to the Einstein-Feynman standard of brilliance, which was not pretty. And then one day I realized that my hero is in fact neither Einstein nor Feynman, but Doc Brown. And once I realized that I was in fact happier as a mad scientist than as a straight one, my life got a lot easier. So I had a fairly good time trying to understand how the brain works or not, including my own, maybe.
Maybe.
Awesome. All right, so are you ready to try to tackle some questions?
The episode to end all episodes.
Yeah, for real.
Well, I think we ought to try to tackle something. So who's the running back on this show?
Yeah. Tim, there was a sports joke and we survived.
We did. I mean, I just sort of half laughed, not knowing really what it meant.
I didn't either, but that's why I thought it would be kind of funny.
All right, here we go.
I actually thought about it for a second. Like, who is the running back on the show? I don't know.
Well, it's really much better than the walking back, because I think when you're walking back, you're going in the wrong direction.
Why don't you hit us with a question?
All right, here we go. My 34 male wife. My 34 male, here we go, wife, 32 female, doesn't respect my work home boundaries and is causing serious issues. My wife works in a highly paid dental profession. She's a prosthodontist. It sounds like a dinosaur. And basically fixes people's teeth and jaws for a living. She had to go to undergrad and dental school for a total of 8 years, and then a residency for 3 years. So she understands professionalism and working. I'm a software engineer with a master's degree. Since COVID, I have been having to work from home. The office for my job is not open yet and not planning until 2022. I prefer working in the office when it's an option. My wife is off on Fridays, and she gets off work sometimes at 2 p.m. and sometimes at 6 p.m. on Monday through Thursday. My problem is that she does not seem to respect my boundaries of WFH, work from home, no matter how nicely I ask. She constantly comes into my office and interrupts me when I'm in deep focus writing code and designing software. She will come up to me in the middle of working and just force her tongue down my throat in an intimate kiss. That would be acceptable any other time, but not while I'm working. She constantly asks me if I want to give... Oh, you know what? I'm going to... Per FCC guidelines, I'm not going to say the rest of that sentence. This started as cute when COVID started, and actually she was home a lot then, but escalated really quickly. I'm not one to fantasize about crossing my work life with my sex life. I get no rise out of... bonk while I'm working. I am very by the books that work time is work time. I also have pretty severe ADHD that is diagnosed, and I take medication for it. It takes me 1.5 to 2 hours to fully ease into a task and to get working. The context switching to her is extraordinarily expensive. Most of the time, it's nothing that can't wait until I'm done working. I've tried asking her not to disturb me at work at all. She gets upset and acts like it's me denying her and being mad at her. I've gotten upset with her over this. It's reached the point where I can't get a solid 30 minutes of work on the days she's home without her interrupting me. I'm not a coffee shop worker either, and I rely heavily on multiple monitors and the closed system of my workspace. I'm very fidgety and get easily distracted, so an open setting like that wouldn't be good for me. I've tried it. The ways I've posed this, quote, imagine you're working on someone's tooth and I pop my head in and ask if you want me to go down on you, or, quote, imagine you're trying to work on a patient and I just pop my head into the room and start staring at you and tell you that I want attention. On one hand, I'm thrilled my wife craves my attention and loves me. On the other hand, I'm more than starting to see it affect my work output. I feel like at times she doesn't respect what I do because she seems to think interrupting me constantly is no big deal. When I flip the situation to interrupting her at work, she pulls the I have patience card. Patience as in the people who show up in the office, not good old, like, not like, you know, being patient with somebody. I think her job is definitely more focus intensive than mine, but I feel like my point and views on the subject are valid and that I just want her to stop interrupting me at work. It actually compounds too much because she interrupts me due to wanting attention. Then I end up working until 8 p.m. to finish what I could have finished by 5 p.m. But she complains that I'm working too much and too late. I've tried to tell her it's due to the interruptions. I rarely have to work this late when I have the day to myself. What can I do to remediate this?
Put a lock on the door.
That's the mechanical engineering answer.
Keep it simple, stupid.
And the electrical engineer's solution to the problem would be to electrify the doorknob.
Oh, there you go. Actually, that's a great idea. You know, like a disposable camera flash mechanism to just tie it to the doorknob.
This is kind of a reprogramming issue. And the trick is to figure out who gets reprogrammed or how. So what are the options? You can reprogram, you can divert, distract, subvert, or revert. So I'm trying to figure out what's the correct way to basically... is this impedance matching? To a large extent, this is an impedance matching problem.
I always say that.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it? It really is.
You know, I mean, I sometimes suffer. Some people have argued that I have ADHD, and I get really pissed off when someone says, hey, who's winning the World Series this year? When people think I have ADHD and it's football season, and I just can't keep my mind on things. So it's, how's the weather at your end of town, Tim?
Pretty cool. It's about 54 degrees.
I didn't get it. Yes.
So the ADHD problem is a real one. And I empathize with the ADHD aspect because it's very hard to be distracted when you're trying to focus. And part of the problem with ADHD is hyper-focus. And so when you want to dig in, you really want to dig deep in. And that's why, in part, this is an impedance matching problem. I'm still trying to figure out what to recommend in this case. What do you think, Tim? Either Tim has inadequate bandwidth or he's hyper-focused on a spot on the wall.
We've got an inadequate bandwidth situation.
So what's your... So Tim, what's your view of how to handle a ADHD impedance mismatch?
Jeez. I don't know, I'm sort of like, I'm like drifting towards all of these like mechanical barrier type resolutions, you know, like actually here's a thing that I did for COVID working from home. I have a strobe light that I put out in the hallway to keep people away from my workspace when I need to be left alone, and I turn it on said strobe light when they are to stay away or feel the wrath.
Well, you have compliant for the most part.
Yeah, that's the trouble.
People in your house, minus Fiona, of course, who complies only to her own rules.
So now I'm sort of drifting back to the electrify the doorknob. It's...
Well, but if we were going to treat this as an impedance...
Yeah, that's not an impedance solution.
The first thing you would do is plot a Smith chart. And by plot a Smith chart, I mean... get out a network, a vector network analyzer, and let the vector network analyzer plot the Smith chart.
Which of our two people that we're discussing is the real person and which one's the imaginary person? Or is this in fact that they each have a real and an imaginary component and they happen to be potentially orthogonal at this point?
Well, there's definitely some imaginary characteristics, or there, yeah, like, there are some things that are being imagined here that aren't real.
So what that says, you basically, if you have to do this rotation in the phase plane, you either have to add some capacitance or some inductance.
I was just thinking that.
And the question is, what in a behavioral situation, capacitance probably translates to empathy, understanding. And inductance, I think, probably translates to inertia. And so what you need to do is you need to give one of the parties some inductance and the other party some capacitance. And hopefully you get everybody lined up rather than 180 degrees apart.
Yes, and there's the question of whether or not the inductors or capacitors are in series, or making, you know, one, putting one in series and one to ground, depending on where, but depending on A, the frequency that we're trying to, the frequency, the impedance, which is presumably 50 ohms if we're talking RF, and what was the other thing? Oh, and the
are we talking RF?
No, the load is 50 ohms. But we have to establish what the frequency is.
You have not only the problem with the frequency, but you can also, well, you can also look at this in the frequency domain and decide whether, in fact, you want a high-pass filter, a low-pass filter, or a lag-lead compensator. And They would all have their, you know, the lag lead compensator would basically let you go from something that's overly filtered in a low pass sense to higher frequency where you start getting noise. So the question is whose response, whose behavior in this situation should be amplified, whose behavior should be attenuated or simply frequency shifted. And what you really want to do is get them to work together rather than opposing each other. So I would suggest a phase shifter that allowed them to come to a compromise where some of her interests get addressed more thoroughly, but at a later time.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to say, because with the capacitor, there would be a point of time where it would charge up, and then it would dissipate. And so having scheduled capacitor dissipation, that's exactly the case.
And I love it.
You can choose the capacitance of said capacitor to see how long it should build up before it dissipates the charge.
I mean, this gets into the series parallel question. You also have to think about whether you want any dissipation. So do you want any resistors? So you're effectively making a filter, and you have to decide, is it high pass, low pass, band pass, and how many poles does it have? And so I'm looking at, from the behavioral point of view, is you probably don't want to dissipate the energy. You don't want to dissipate the energy in the wrong place. You want to basically transform it and utilize it possibly at a different place or possibly a different time. And then I'm trying to figure out what you actually do. And the problem with the electrified doorknob is it seems a bit of a discouraging rather than encouraging approach. So, you know, a doorknob coated with glue would also have a different behavior.
Just like a big fly sheet.
Yeah, well, there's that Han Solo picture of Han Solo frozen against the wall.
He was frozen in carbonite.
So the question is who gets frozen in carbonite and when? I'm not sure the carbonite solution is particularly good. I think it's higher risk. But I'm still serious about the phase shifting, impedance matching. It's hard to change someone's behavior, but one could imagine a reward structure that made it in everybody's to everybody's advantage to define a new algorithm. Then this current one does not look like it's converging on a happy solution.
Yeah, we are far from 50 ohms.
Yeah.
Oh, very.
There could be some severe ringing right now.
Oh, yeah, but the filter is wrong. It looks like you tried to put a filter in place and it's self-oscillating.
Oh, yeah, we're getting reflections.
Yes. Yes, I think that's right. I think there's a very serious case of reflections.
Yeah, the VSWR meter is like...
Oh, boy.
If you're still listening... Wave Pharmacy is a show where we take emotional problems and have them analyzed with engineering and scientific principles by experts in their field. We also have technical and engineering problems which are solved by mental health professionals. We alternate each week. Again, we're here today with our very special guest, Dr. John Wixwo. We're thrilled to have you here.
Understatement.
shall we start the next question, or you have more thoughts?
Have we provided an adequate solution to this previous dilemma?
I believe we have.
So.
Yeah.
I mean, the bottom line is figure out the dynamics of what is happening, and rather than trying to change them, try to transform them, preferably with some kind of reward structure.
Or fast food.
Yes. And I think if we're careful, we're going to get to heterodyny, where you basically get to look at the sum and difference frequencies and start worrying about sidebands. We clearly have a problem of impedance matching and frequency mismatch, and that is not delivering proper power transfer, which is the whole purpose of impedance matching. And so we want to basically take each of these people's energy and try to appropriately transfer them to the other person without blowing anything up. Why don't we move on to the next problem now that we got this one completely solved?
All right. The answer is always a ring modulator. It's offensive. Okay. Here we go. You ready? Does anyone else ever get really anxious on whether they have cancer? Ever since I was a kid, I've always been terrified that I have or will get cancer. As a kid, I remember going to sleep hoping I won't have cancer, and that would happen every night. When I was in high school, it calmed down, but now it has come back really bad. Last week, I noticed tiny red spots on my arm, but this morning my doctor said they didn't look to be anything to worry about. But just as the phone consultation ended, I noticed a mole on my leg that looks a little bit different from the last time I saw it. Now I can't stop Googling it and thinking about it. I've noticed when there is a medical show on that it will make me worry I'll become ill and have to go to the hospital. Seriously, those shows are the worst. What advice do we have for this person?
Turn your computer off.
Yeah. It's like when you have a bad sensor and you're getting this information that you can't trust. But it's hard if you don't know exactly what the sensor is. Or like, you know, if you have some kind of test equipment, test tool that's not giving you a correct readout, sometimes it takes you a really long time to figure out exactly which piece of that puzzle is not working properly, while pulling your head out, of course.
I would like to empathize with the person who asked this question, because 22 years ago I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and had a radical prostatectomy, and at my one-year visit, I asked the surgeon, surgeon friend, really good guy, what are the odds of my cancer coming back, which is basically functionally equivalent to the writer's, or the call-in, have you call this, the write-in person's comment about will they get cancer, and he said, oh, your odds are excellent. And I said, well, how good? He says, they're really very, very good. And he says, look, I want a number. So he opens up my chart and he looks at it. And he says, odds are excellent. The odds of your tumor coming back are only 1 in 10. And I said that in terms of odds of getting, previously I had been rating my risk behavior on the odds of getting killed commuting. So how many people, Tim, do you know who've been killed commuting?
Zero.
Okay, how many people do you know that you would recognize by name or face over your entire life?
Four.
No.
Oh, that's it? That's the end of the question?
No, I want to know. We have to do this logic. So how many people would you... You see this person, you say, I recognize this person. You put that person in the I recognize people box. So how many people are in your I'd recognize this person box? Not counting national, you know, public figures, but classmates, friends, co-workers. therapists, physicians, competitors,
arch nemesis,
vendors.
maybe 30?
No, you happen to know more than that in your entire life. You're meeting more than one person a year, and you're at least 30.
I mean, well, my ability to recall who they are is a whole...
No, just to say recognize.
Oh, okay. Could I put a number on that? I don't know. Although, that may be your point. Maybe a couple hundred if I ballpark it?
I think that's a good number. I would say that it's a safe bet for me as a teacher who's taught lots of students, some of whom I may not recognize. It's clearly on the order of 1,000. So that basically said the odds of dying of cancer, of my cancer coming back, is 1 in 10 compared to the odds of getting killed commuting, which are less than 1 in 1,000, maybe 1 in 10,000. I told this to a friend. He says, "Well, John, looks to me like you can stop worrying about commuting." So on the second year, I went back and had my exam and my PSA test, and I said, "Okay, surgeon friend, what are my odds this year?" And he looks at my chart and looks at me. He says, 1 in 100. So on the third year, I went back and I said, "What are my odds?" And he says, 1 in 1,000. And you know what you're going to die of, John? I said, "Well, I'm not going to die of this." He says, "You're going to die of overanalysis." So I think the problem here is that we have a problem not of cancer, but a problem of overanalysis. So I actually found that fairly reassuring, because my solution to the problem is to try to distract myself when I start dwelling on that fact. And it turns out that at some point, the probability of me getting prostate cancer again is lower than the odds of the standard U.S. white male population. So I went to a dermatologist for a once every few year mole check. And he looked at my chart and he says, "So your prostate cancer's in remission." And I found that very, very sobering. And the bottom line is, I went back to the surgeon and he says, "Well, officially he's probably right, but you should consider yourself cured." So I think with regard to the concerns about every mole, you want to be attentive to the reality. The odds of a mole turning into a melanoma are quite low. You need to get it looked at if it's of concern, and not get it out of perspective, because you have the odds of getting killed commuting. And I used to bicycle at high speeds at long distances. I think my top speed on a road bike was 52 miles an hour. And my longest distance in a single day was probably 100, 120 miles. I used to do 70 miles every weekend. On my second near-fatal wreck, where I did a face plant coming down a mountain, I'm lying in the hospital, and I started computing the odds of me getting killed biking compared to the odds of me getting killed commuting versus the odds of me coming down with cancer. And I was realizing that I was getting a surgical intervention every 3,000 miles, and came to the conclusion that biking was too dangerous for me, and that was tied into the previously mentioned ADHD. And it is probably not good to be a high-speed, long-distance bicycle rider with ADHD, because you find something shiny on the side of the road and you'll drive into a pothole, which punched a hole in my elbow at one point. But the bottom line is, it's worth calculating the odds and trying to respond appropriately. So at a Department of Defense conference that I was attending, there was a psychologist doing a reporting on a study of the psychology of bad news. And apparently this guy's research project was to figure out what's the best way to tell the mayor of a small town that there's a large green cloud coming towards his town. And it was a perfectly fine study that talks about the issue. And so I said, what about people who embark on risky behaviors like road biking? One of my accidents, I was going 3 miles an hour, so it's not the speed. Another one of my accidents, I was stationary, so it's not speed at all. But there was a question of what happens with risky behavior. And he says, it's not that the people underestimate the risk. They underestimate the consequences of the risk. So it appears to me in the case of the case we're studying is that there is an overestimate of the risk of these moles. And one just needs to figure out how to ground oneself in something approximating reality, which is really hard to do when you're obsessing on a mole. So I obsess on all sorts of things until I get distracted. So I think the best thing to do is to figure out a means to distract oneself, possibly with complicated mathematical computation, detailed drawing, learning how to do pointillist paintings, one dot at a time. But then you got to be careful, because if you take the pointillist approach, you'll say that's one mole at a time, and that's going in the wrong direction. So I think the trick is to figure out how to do a risk-benefit analysis and basically figure that what you might die of is not cancer but anxiety. And so the trick is to figure out, and this is the pot calling the kettle black, the trick is to figure out a simple solution to stop worrying, you know, like the ancient Alfred E. Newman, what me worry? So I think that there's got to be a line drawn somewhere where you spend less metabolic energy worrying about events of low probability and focus your attention on events of higher probability, which may well be the odds of getting killed commuting. So when I'm driving down the road and think about using my cell phone, I simply look at the odds of getting killed commuting, and I realize they go up vastly if I use my cell phone. So going back to the subject at hand, do a complete analysis of all risky behaviors, assign probabilities to all of them, and kick the ones that are the most likely to kill you, which is why I'm no longer biking, because biking and my ADHD are not compatible. So that's a long diatribe, but it's
mindfulness.
Wow.
Yeah. That's amazing. You know, I was thinking, when you said to get grounded, what happens in a circuit when the ground is floating?
Floating grounds are dangerous. Multiple floating grounds are dangerous. Ground loops are a nightmare.
Yeah.
So I think that if you are worrying about too many things at one time, you've effectively created a potential ground loop. And it's kind of like if you start worrying about worrying, you have something to worry about.
Very well put. What are you, a professor or something?
I'm a mad scientist.
Yeah, the feedback loop.
All right, do we have time for one more?
I think we do. All right.
I should really just be taking the advice of this program. Forget being a host on it.
You belong.
Thank you.
Okay. Here's our next question. To cope with my depression, I dream up unlikely scenarios about me getting back to the instance I was genuinely happy and my depression wasn't on my mind. Then I realize it is severely unlikely, if not impossible, to happen, and I get depressed again. After that, I feel guilty thinking about it because I should have moved on and shouldn't be stuck in the past. It's a vicious cycle, and I know it's pretty pathetic. Does anyone else go through something similar? This is
Oh boy.
Have you ever seen, Tim, have you ever seen the coupled pendula demonstration where you take two weights and you hang them from the ceiling and connect them at the top by a very, very thin elastic band or just by the nature of the ceiling? And you swing one pendulum and it goes back and forth and back and forth, and then the energy is moved over to the other pendulum and it goes back and forth and back and forth, and then the energy eventually moves back. Have you seen that demonstration?
I have, yes.
Okay, well, I think in some ways that describes oscillations of moods. And so you can have a happy person, correction, a person in a happy state that is swinging back and forth. And that energy then gets moved to the other state, which is then, there are still the oscillations, but they're the unhappy flavor. It's the other pendulum. And I need to see the question again because I'd like to look at it.
Yes. This isn't a bad question. Here.
I mean, I'm deeply empathetic to this depression problem because it's a matter of state space that you are. In your daily life, orbiting a point that's not particularly pleasant. And the trick is, can you figure out how to give a jolt to the system to get into a orbit around a different place? So in physics speak, you have an attractor that you're orbiting in this highly dimensional phase space. And the human psyche is phenomenally complicated and highly dimensioned. And I deeply empathize for anyone who has a depressive attractor in their psychological phase space that they latch onto and orbit around. And the tendency of the human brain, and particularly the pharmaceutical industry, is to figure out a single thing you can do to get out from one attractor to another. But it's not clear that that's really the way the whole system works. So I guess my advice is, rather than think of a single genuinely happy instance, think of the various things that one could adjust collectively to give you the result you want. Because in the pharmaceutical industry made billions of dollars until it ran out of the one drug, one gene, one disease scenario. And the problem is what's called polypharmacy. So how do you get multiple things to work to change a situation from a stable state, let's say, of depression to a stable state of satisfaction? And I think, in my mind, that the challenge is assuming that a single intervention can kick you from one state to the other. And the energetics might not work out, which means that, so as another analogy, you have some processes that you need two photons to get to work. So the question is, what combination of stimuli or inputs or behavioral changes or environmental changes get one out of this state, or by the same token, get one into the state? And it's a matter of trying to sort through the details of events going in both directions to learn how to weight one state more than the other. But this is not a solution to the problem, because all I'm offering is self-examination and observation of multiple factors. And it's hard enough to just one factor, but I say, you know, find two or three.
Actually, though, it reminded me of something. Tim, do you remember when we were working on the MySQL database, and you were trying to explain to me how databases work to optimize speed.
Maybe.
So, if you consider your memories of different times in your life to be entries in a database, then if you were to use the most simple basic approach to scan through all the database entries, then it would, A, require an enormous amount of power. The power consumption would be tremendous. It would take all of the time that you had as you're just scanning through all of these database entries. And something that has come along since then, from what I understand, is that a database will pre-calculate certain things that it suspects you will ask for. So, for example, the median, the average, the minimum, the maximum value in a database. And if a person has indexed their memories in a MySQL style situation, then they're referencing certain things in the database while scanning through all of them without really properly categorizing them, wasting tons of time and energy, right, on this database. And also, the database is, we don't know anything about it. We don't know if the database is complete. We don't know if the queries are actually what was requested. You know, we don't know. So what I think my suggestion would be in the form of a database conundrum would be to say you have this database that you're constantly getting data from. For every request that you put in for data on this database, request data from another database. All the databases can't be full of, you know, good memories that were in the past and all the recent things that happen now are bad. I think that the instead of organizing by good and bad, you can restructure the way that you ask for data, so you can have, you know, well, my life was so great then, but there was also a bad time that I had in that same time period. And this bad thing happened to me now, but there's a good thing that happened to me. And even if you really have to reach into the database, really reach into the database, acknowledging that good things happen to you all the time, every day, somewhere, if you dig down far enough.
You're bringing up some extremely good points, but there's also a subtlety of databases about which I know a little bit, only dangerously a little bit. The problem with MySQL is these relational databases with structural query languages are all working on collections of flat tables. So you have a two-dimensional sheet, and you're going to be having a sheet that might, let's say, be labeled good experiences, and another sheet is a table that might be bad experiences. But it turns out that neither Facebook nor LinkedIn would be able to have that little plot that says how many degrees of separation between you and some other person. Were they doing that with SQL queries? Those happen to be very, very hard queries. So what you end up wanting to do is switch from MySQL to Neo4j, which is a graphical database that stores all sorts of metadata with each data point, but allows you to compute effectively a Pythagorean distance between any two random points. So what happens then is that you don't simply go pull up your sheet of good experiences and your sheet of bad experiences. You pull up a network, a graphical network of all of your experiences. And then you say, well, how many steps between this bad experience and this good experience? And what is the connection or the grading of the experience? And so you come up with a richer database that happens to be computationally harder to store, but it enables a much greater richness in query. And that's why Neo4j, I think Neo4j was powering either Facebook or LinkedIn or both, just because the graph database allows you to make connections of far distant people. So this is, you know, the 6 degrees of separation problem written for the planet. But that also applies to the 6 degrees of separation for personal experiences. So you don't say, okay, this is a good experience and this is a bad experience, and this goes on the good experience sheet of flat paper and that goes on the bad experience sheet of flat paper. And, you know, when you have a spreadsheet that has 115,000 entries, you have a data problem. I've gotten around that problem recently when I was handed sheets with thousands of entries as to learn pivot tables. And I think the same thing applies to connections between data. So my advice to this person is to figure out a means of bookkeeping to better classify experiences in their full richness. So that would be my advice.
Excellent. For those of our listeners who are not in the studio now, Tim's jaws on the floor. I have to make a point.
I haven't closed my mouth since we started recording.
Amazing.
Wow.
Well, is there anything that you would like to close with for our listeners, or anything you'd like to just to say, get out on the airwaves before we go?
I just have a deep sense of empathy to people that are writing into your program, and I hope that we have treated their problems with due respect. They are real problems and real people. And while we might be a little bit glib, there is a advice that a friend of mine gave me 45 years ago. It's best to get through life if you can find yourself mildly amusing. And so when I discovered that, in fact, when I admitted to myself that I was a mad scientist, I came bounding home and said to my wife, "Wife, I've just discovered I'm a mad scientist." And she looks at me and kind of rolls her eyes, and she said, "What took you so long?" 40 years. So I think my friend Jerry's advice years ago, which was to find yourself mildly amusing, is an asset. So I tend to be able to laugh at myself as I'm castigating myself for what I'm not. And so sometimes the humor hides the imposter syndrome, and sometimes the humor cures the imposter syndrome. But I empathize with all of these people who have concerns that causes them to write in, and I respect those problems, and I hope that they can find a suitable solution or a means to work around it.
Thank you so, so much for joining us. This has been amazing.
It's my pleasure.
I'd give a standing ovation if it wouldn't mean that I was disconnecting all of my cables attached to my body right now.
I need to spill your whiskey glass, too. In that yeah.
All right. Well, as always, if you have any issues you would like to be discussed on Wave Pharmacy, whether they are technical issues or emotional issues, feel free to send us an email at wavepharmacy@gmail.com. That's wavepharmacy@gmail.com. And we will see you all next month.
Thank you.